You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Light Course, given to the Waldorf schools, the teachers. This is the fifth lecture, given in Stuttgart on December 27, 1919. As well as we can with our limited means, we are going to begin today by showing you the experiment we spoke about yesterday. You undoubtedly remember that I said that when a glowing solid emits light, and we send this light through a prism, we get a spectrum, a light image similar to that of the sun. When we have a glowing gas that emits light, we also get a light image, but it shows actual light lines or light bands in only one place, or for various substances in several places. The rest of the spectrum is atrophied. By carrying out exact experiments, we would see that actually a complete spectrum is present for everything that glows. In other words, a spectrum that ranges from red to violet. If, for example, we produce a spectrum with glowing sodium gas, then we simply have a very, very weak spectrum, and in one spot, a stronger yellow line, which by contrast mutes everything else. We therefore say that sodium yields nothing but this yellow line. Now there is an odd fact, which was known by many earlier, and then reconfirmed by the experiment of Bunsen and Kirchhoff in 1859. If we have a light source that produces a continuous spectrum, and acting simultaneously, so to speak, a light source that produces something like the sodium line, then this sodium line acts simply like an opaque body. It opposes the very color quality that would be at that spot, in this case yellow, and extinguishes it, so that instead of the yellow we have a black line there. In other words, if we stick to the facts, what we can say is that for the yellow in the spectrum, another yellow, which has to be at least as strong as the yellow generated at this spot, acts like an opaque body. As you will see, there will be a basis for understanding this in the elements we are putting together. First, we must stick to what is factual. Now, we will show, as well as we can, that this black line is really in the spectrum when we add in the glowing sodium. We aren't able to do the experiment here in such a way that we capture the spectrum, so instead we'll do it a way that lets us study the spectrum by looking at it with our eyes. That way we can also see the spectrum, but instead of being displaced upward, it will be reversed, displaced downward, and the colors will be reversed. Remember that we spoke about why the colors appear like this when I simply look through the prism. Will produce the beam of light with this apparatus here. Let it pass through here, and look at the broken beam of light here. Thus, at the same time we're looking at that, we'll see the black sodium line. I hope you'll be able to see it, but you'll have to approach and look in perfect military order, which shouldn't be too difficult in Germany right now. The experiment is shown to everyone individually. Now, we still want to use the short time remaining to us, so we'll have to move on to a discussion of the relationship of the colors to the so-called bodies. As an approach to the problem of finding this relationship, I want to show you the following. You see the complete spectrum captured on the screen. In the path of the light beam, I now place a small trough containing carbon disulfide in which some iodine is dissolved, and ask you to observe the resulting change in the spectrum. You see that you have a clear spectrum here, and when I place the solution of iodine in carbon disulfide in the path of the light beam, it extinguishes the light completely. Now you see the spectrum clearly separated into two parts, because the middle part has been extinguished. Thus you see only violet on one side and yellowish red on the other. In this way, because I let the light pass through the solution of iodine in carbon disulfide, you see the complete spectrum separated into two parts, and you see only the two poles. I have really lost a lot of time and will only be able now to talk about some principles. Isn't it so that the key question concerning the relationship of the colors to the bodies we see about us, and all bodies are colored in a certain way, must be to explain how it is that these bodies appear colored? In other words, how they have a certain relationship of their own to light. How they develop a relationship to light through their material being. One body appears red, another blue, etc. Naturally, the simplest way to manage is by saying that when colorless sunlight, which for the physicist means a collection of all colors, falls on a body that then appears red, that stems from the fact that the body swallows all the other colors and reflects only red. It is also easy to explain how a body is blue. It simply swallows all other colors and reflects only blue. For us, it is a matter of completely excluding such a speculative explanatory principle and of approaching the somewhat complicated fact that we see the so-called colored bodies by way of the facts, by lining up fact upon fact in order to capture something that presents itself as the most complicated of phenomena. The following will lead us onto the path. We remember that in the 17th century, when people were still doing a lot of alchemy, they spoke of the so-called phosphorus substances, the light bearers. At that time, by, in quotes, phosphorus, they meant the following. A shoemaker in Bologna, to take an example, was experimenting alchemically with a kind of barite, the so-called Bologna stone. He exposed it to light, and the remarkable phenomenon occurred that whenever he exposed the stone to light, it shone with a particular color for a time afterward. Thus the Bologna stone had developed a relationship to light, which it expressed by continuing to shine even after the light had been taken away. Therefore, such stones, which were being investigated in various ways after this fashion, were called phosphorus. So if you encounter the expression phosphorus in the literature of this time, you shouldn't take it to mean what we mean by it today, but rather phosphorescent bodies, light-bearers, phosphors. Now, however, this phenomenon of the afterglow of phosphorescence isn't actually the basic one. A different phenomenon is the basic one. If you take ordinary oil and look through it toward something that is shining, you will see the oil is faint yellow. If, however, you place yourself so that you allow the light to pass through the oil and look at it from behind, the oil will appear to glow with a bluish light, but only as long as light is shining on it. You can carry out this experiment with various other bodies. It gets particularly interesting when you dissolve chlorophyll. If you look through such a solution into the light, it appears green. But if you place yourself behind it, so to speak, with the solution here and the light passing through here, so that you now see the place where the light passes through from behind, then the chlorophyll shines back with a reddish color, red, just as the oil shines blue, see figure 5a. There are bodies of the most various kinds that shine differently when they themselves send light back, so to speak, than when the light passes through them as through a transparent body. That is, they show that they have entered into a relationship with the light, which is transformed by their own nature. If we look at the chlorophyll from behind, we see what the light has accomplished in the chlorophyll, so to speak, the relationship between the light and the chlorophyll. This phenomenon of a body shining with a light while being illuminated by another light is called fluorescence. And we can ask, but what is phosphorescence? It's just a kind of fluorescence that lasts. When chlorophyll, for example, appears reddish, as long as light is acting on it, that is fluorescence. With phosphorescence, we can take away the light and barite, for example, continues to shine a little. In other words, it retains the characteristic of giving off colored light, while chlorophyll does not. So you have two stages. One is fluorescence. We cause a body to be colored as long as we shine a light on it. The second stage is phosphorescence. We cause a body to continue to be colored for a certain time afterward. And then there is a third stage. The body appears permanently colored by means of something that light does with it. Fluorescence, phosphorescence, a body's state of being colored. Here we've lined the phenomena up next to each other, so to speak. Now it's only a matter of approaching the phenomena with our ideas in an appropriate way. To do that, you will need to take in a certain idea that we will be working on together with all of this. Now, I'll ask you once more to think absolutely only about what I'm presenting to you and to think as exactly and precisely as possible. And I'll remind you of the formula for velocity, V. As you know, any velocity, however fast, is expressed by dividing the distance, d, by the time, t, so that the formula reads V equals d divided by t. Now, the opinion persists that somewhere in nature there is a distance, d, in space that has been traveled, and a time, t, during which the distance in space was traveled, and that we then divide the real distance in space by the real time to get the velocity, which we actually regard as something that is not quite real. Rather, we regard it more as a function, as something we arrive at as the result of calculations. That is not how it is in nature. Of these three quantities, velocity, space, and time, velocity is actually the only real one. Velocity is the one that is outside us. We arrive at the others, d and t, only by dividing, by splitting, so to speak, the unified v into two abstract things, which we create on the basis of the existing velocity. We proceed more or less as follows. We see a so-called body fly with a certain velocity through space. The sole reality is that it has velocity. However, instead of contemplating the totality of this flying body, we now think in two abstractions. We divide something that is a unity into two abstractions. Because there is a velocity, there is a certain path. We consider that first. Then we consider the time during which this path is covered, isolating space and time by our thinking process. However, this space is only there because the velocity makes it, and the time is no different. Space and time, as related to this real thing, which we designate with V, are not realities but abstractions, which we just fashion from the velocity. And we will not be able to cope with outer reality until we realize that we, in our thinking process, have created this duality of space and time, that velocity is the only real thing outside of us, if you like, and we only created space and time from the two abstractions into which velocity can be divided. We can detach ourselves from velocity, but we can't detach ourselves from space and time. They are integral to our perception, to our perceptual activity. We are one with space and time. Think about that. We are not one with the velocity outside, but with space and time. Indeed, we shouldn't be so quick to ascribe to external bodies that with which we ourselves are one. Rather, we should use the fact that we are one with space and time in an appropriate way to arrive at a conception of external bodies. We should say, quote, because of space and time, with which we are intimately connected, we learn to recognize velocity. Close quote. However, we shouldn't also say that a body requires time. Rather only, quote, a body has velocity. By means of space and time we measure velocity. Space and time are our instruments, and they are bound to us. That is the important thing. Close quote. Here in space and time, you see once again the so-called subjective, clearly differentiated from the so-called objective, which is velocity. It will be very good if you understand this very, very clearly. But then it will become apparent to you that V isn't merely the quotient of D and T. Rather, what I express here with a number has an inherent reality on its own terms, whose essence consists in having a velocity. What I have shown you here for space and time, that they are not separable from us at all, that we may not separate ourselves from them, is also true of something else. These days there is still a lot of Königsbergism in people, I mean Kantianism. This Königsbergism has to be gotten rid of completely, because somebody could believe that just now I had spoken in the spirit of Königsbergism. In that case we would say, quote, space and time are in us, close quote. But I am not saying that space and time are in us. Rather, in perceiving the objective velocity, we use space and time for perception. Space and time are simultaneously inside us and outside us, but we form a bond with space and time, whereas we don't form a bond with velocity. The latter roars right past us. In other words, it is something essentially different from Kantian Königsbergism. What I have said about space and time is also true of another thing. Just as we are connected to objectivity by space and time, but have to search first for velocity, we are in the same element with the so-called bodies, in that we see them by means of light. We may no more speak of the objectivity of light than we may speak of the objectivity of space and time. We float in space and time, just as bodies float in it at a certain velocity. We float in light, as bodies float in light. Light is an element we share in common with what is outside of us in the form of so-called bodies. You can imagine it like this. If you have gradually illuminated the darkness with light, then space fills up with something. Let's call it X, if you like. Something that both you and that thing outside you are inside of, a common element in which you and the elements are floating. Now we have to wonder how we do that, how we float in the light there. We can't float in it with our so-called body, but we do float in it with our etheric body. We won't be able to understand light unless we get on to realities. We float in the light with our etheric body. If you like, you can say in the light ether. That's not so important. So we float in the light with our etheric body. Now in the course of our time here, we have seen how colors emerge in all different ways in and under light. Colors also emerge in the so-called bodies, or persist in them. We see ghostly colors, so to speak, which emerge and disappear in light. If I just project a spectrum, it is like ghosts. It flits about in space, so to speak. In and under light, we see colors of this sort. How can that be? We float in light with our etheric body. How are we related to the colors that flit about? The only possibility is that we are inside them with our astral body. We are joined to the colors with our astral body. There's no alternative but to realize that wherever you see colors, you are joined to the colors with your astrality. In order to achieve real insight, There's no alternative but to say to yourself that although light actually remains invisible, we are floating in it. Just as we shouldn't call space and time objective entities because we float in them with things, we should also regard light as our common element. We should regard the colors, however, as something that can appear only because we enter with our astral body into a relationship with what the light is doing there. There's a figure 5b, he's now going to refer to that. Let's assume, however, that somehow you have produced some kind of color phenomenon, some kind of spectrum, in this space here, A, B, C, D, but a phenomenon that happens only in the light, see figure 5b. Here you will have to go back to an astral relationship with the light. However, you could have colored this here as the surface so that AC as a body appears red to you. For example, we say AC is red. Then you look at the surface of the body and at first have the rough idea that under the surface of the body it is red through and through. You see, that is something different. There you also have an astral relationship, but you are separated by the surface of the body from the astral relationship you enter into with the color. Try to conceive of that. In the light you see colors, colors of the spectrum. There you have astral relations of a direct nature. Nothing comes between you and these colors. You see the colors of the body. Something comes between them and your astral body, and yet you enter into astral relations with the colors of the body. I'd like you to take these things to heart and think them through clearly, because they are important fundamental concepts, which we will be working on. And only by doing that will we develop fundamental concepts for a real study of physics. In closing, I would just like to mention one more thing. I am not trying to talk to you about what you could easily get for yourself by buying the first textbook that comes along. I also don't want to tell you about what you can read if you read Goethe's Theory of Color. Rather, I want to tell you about what you can't find in either, but which will enable you to nourish yourself intellectually from both in a suitable way. Even if we aren't true believers in physics, we don't need to become true believers in Goethe. Goethe died in 1832, and we don't confess to an 1832 Goetheanism, but rather to one of the year 1919. In other words, to a Goetheanism that has continued its education. I would particularly like you to think over what I said to you today about the astral relationship. The end of Lecture 5.